Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live the lighter side of genocide 5 days a week, 2 hours a day for your listening pleasure. In need of donations and subscriptions, we are all slaves to money, no matter even if it's made up. You still need it to survive. Isn't that interesting? So if you'd like to subscribe to the Vinnie Eastwood Show and give some of your slave money to this cause of giving interesting people a little bit of a platform to talk about their interesting stuff, then you can go to the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. For as little a dollar a month, we will give you commercial-free Vinnie Eastwood Show archives. Saves an awful lot of listening time and really contributes to the flow of the programs and the discussions that we have on here sometimes. My very special guest is Victor H. Fisher, and you were talking about the relationship between the Japanese and the Chinese economies. Do you believe that these banking systems that the Chinese are instituting now, you know, with the People's Bank and all of that, do you think that that's really going to shift the kind of grandiose global agenda of the private bankers?
Yes, no two ways about it. The bottom line is that there's an old adage, a thousand-year-old adage, he who has the has the gold writes the rules. And United States is still claiming that they have 8,000 tons of gold that is under their control, sitting there in various locations like West Point and Fort Knox and those kinds of things, areas underneath the Bank of Federal Reserve Bank of New York. There's a big a deposit of bullion there, but virtually 100% or more. In fact, my sense is that there's more gold that is, well, as far as bullion is concerned, it's 100% is actually owned by other countries or other people that the we're just storing the gold. And so that, and I think that because of the leadership for the last at least 20 years has sold gold certificates, which are not backed by any gold. So we're in, my sense is that we're in a really a negative. If everybody makes claim to their gold in the States, that they're not going to get it.
Unless the dude actually has the coin or the bar in his frickin' hand, he doesn't have any gold.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, unfortunately, that's the situation now with gold. And silver's in the same boat, really.
Hold on a second. That means that they're in the global gold market and ostensibly the silver market too, there's a lot of gold and silver missing. I wonder how much fake gold is out there that doesn't really exist and how much is it being used to prop up the market, maybe force up the price of gold or something like that, like keeping it artificially low?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'll give you a perfect example. Last Friday, the Federal Reserve System bought, well, they didn't really even buy it. It's called a naked short, which means that you don't put up any front money. 500 tons of gold futures, and they shorted it. So that 500 tons of just paper that affected the market, and it dropped 5% and within 1 day, the price of gold.
Whoa.
Wow. 500 tons.
That doesn't, and that 500 tons of gold doesn't exist?
Doesn't exist. No.
And are they talking about just 500 tons of gold, or are they talk that paper represents, or have they actually got 500 tons of paper worth of gold receipts?
For all practical purposes, it could be that 500 tons of paper.
it's volumetric currency wars. I love it.
Yeah. So, you know, this is, in fact, that gives you a good indication how much paper, well, how susceptible the market is. But at the same time, interestingly enough, just within a few days, just this past week or so, China bought 100 tons of gold, and of gold bullion, of the real stuff. So they've increased their gold holdings. Last year they increased it by 800 tons. And this year it'll be well over 1,000 tons that they'll increase their stockpile. But see, here again, just look at what they have to work with. The United States currency, they are holding $3,000 as a creditor to... to the debtor of the United States, Federal Reserve and Treasury. So
you just said $3,000. Are you sure you didn't miss out like a couple of zillion zeros?
I'm off by a few thousand. $3 trillion.
So the Chinese are holding $3 trillion that they could pretty much either pull or dump or do something with at any point,
right,
completely.
That's
collapse
right.
The U.S.
Well,
economy.
They're dumping it, a lot of it into gold and silver, and they're also buying up a whole bunch of projects like in Africa and stuff like that. So they're not holding very many. Most of that $3 trillion has already been, for all practical purposes, been spent.
Well, when we're talking about this massive amount of paper fake gold that exists, what occurred to me is somebody must be taking the real stuff and hoarding it because they know that all this other stuff is fake. Who are those people?
And that's what I was just saying, that both China, Russia, India, India and China are about equal in acquiring gold as far as buying gold is concerned. Now, China actually got bigger, is now the main source of mined gold. South Africa used to be the leader in mining gold, but China now is a leader as far as the world is concerned. But China has never sold 1 ounce of mined gold. They're just hoarding it. And that's a figure that is not fully made public, put that way.
And what are they doing with all this gold? Are they giving it to some kind of dragon that like has it in a giant nest or lair or something like that?
Well, they're obviously in locked up facilities. The new airport in Hong Kong that was built just a few years ago is underneath it. The airport are a big warehouse for gold. Up until they haven't really absorbed Hong Kong, and for very good reasons. It is a financial capital of banks financial houses like Bear Stearns and these other guys, Goldman Sachs. They are in and have outlets there in Hong Kong. So it's Hong Kong is a good source, as a alternate purchaser of gold. So the mainland will buy gold independent of Hong Kong, and then they transfer the Hong Kong gold over to the mainland. But China owns a large number. A few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, obtained a number of 250 major banks around the world, and so public banks, and so they are, and some of them very, very large banks, and those are good sources for buying gold on behalf of China. So basically, my sense is that China's set up sort of interesting from an organizational point of view. The propaganda about China is that Communist Party rules China. Well, the Communist Party, by name, is the administrator of the government of China, but the Chinese economy is certainly not a communist economy. The Chinese like to call it a socialist with Chinese characteristics, and what that sort of means that it's sort of a hybrid type of organization. Under a true communist like Russia and China, when Mao was in control, a true communist means that the government owns all enterprises. All companies are owned by the government and are controlled, planning and controlled by the government. So when you live in a true communist country, you work for the government, no matter what. If you're alive, you work for the government, or else you have to be a self-employed, entrepreneurial type individual or family. I just saw a few months ago, there are 40,000 registered companies in China, and 250 of them are called state-owned enterprises. So the government is now these sort of the big companies, like railroads and utilities and coal and oil and things like that, but they only own and control. But see, here in China, also as contrasted to Mao or Stalin communism, all of the state-owned companies, number one, they have to pay taxes, and number two, they have to pay dividends to the government. So the state-owned operations have to be competitive.
It sounds very much like a trust
worldwide, and so that they have to make a profit. So Chinese are very profit sensitive, profit oriented, profit operation. Now they. We just had a change in government now, as of now, March, beginning of March, and that new government was appointed by, theoretically, what's printed is that it was nominated and elected by the People's Party, the National People's Party, and of China, which is designated as NPC, and that group is just a few people shy of 3,000 members, and that's their Congress. And that group is the propaganda on that group is that it's a rubber stamp, and it's just for show. But in reality, it is not any more rubber stamped than our Congresses, especially the Democratic Party. So it's sort of silly to say that 3,000 people that are elected locally are just a rubber stamp operation that the leadership is involved with controlling everything. Now, there is another major organization that is almost on the same level as the NPC, the Congress, and that is has a designation of CPPCC, and it is a consulting think tank. And that group is, I forget how many people are involved with it. It's fairly large number. It's in the thousands, we'll put it that way. But these are all, it's broken up into, I think, like nine subdivisions. And they're sort of parallel to the ministerial level of the Congress.
Well, hold on a second there, man, because when you said it was just a rubber stamp organization, I said, what? Aren't all governments supposed to be? What else are they there for? We'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, 5 days a week for your listening and brain juice flowing, eargasm pleasure with my very special guest, Victor H. Fisher. Yeah, well, I actually managed to rhyme that one. How interesting. Victor, you were talking about China and... Right. Trying to give the insider's perspective on what's actually really going on in the country. Is it just me being cynical to say it matters not the perks of the Chinese economy or the American economy or any of them, because underneath it all, they're still predicated by scumbaggery?
No, not in China. Now, during that the 10 years or so, I don't know what his full tenure was, Mao, it tried to westernize, in a sense, itself, and thinking that the West had better governments and things like that. And that's, to a large extent, the reason why Mao... selected communism was a Western system of control and organization of a government. But as history now has recorded, it was a disaster. And that's what happened with communism in Russia, is that it turned out to be a disaster, too. And so what a Putin operation is a non-communist system. And so, but the but see, in China, it had been a imperial organization for thousands of years, warlords or imperial. But see, the problem that imperial and warlords have is that their armies could never be big enough to control the whole country. And when I first came to China back in 1987, I was told by a Chinese, obviously, that China has never been conquered, and he included by its own leadership, because there is never any leader that was able to control all of his citizens. Because there are just too many, and the country is too large. So, ended up is that the citizens had to become self-sufficient and had to earn their own money and their what they did is they set up a family system. And that the family it was an independently employed company, you might call it, or venture, or enterprise, and then they have what they call or is called an extended family, which means that they will only interact with individuals that they would consider as being a personal friend. Because here again, they were always concerned on a defensive basis as to protection against various warlords or bandits, coming into their villages. And so that was their security, was through this this attitude of extended families. But the Chinese, through the 5,000 years of, or 7,000 years, as some of the people are saying, have been, had to be, for own survival, had to become self-sufficient. And so they're very, the average citizen here, is very apolitical. They really don't pay much attention to the government, except
It's the same here.
I'm sorry.
It's the same here in New Zealand.
The same thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Except everybody kind of lives in a perpetual cycle of just working to survive, and they don't care about politics. They just go out drinking every weekend and try to get the nicer way. I mean, basically, we're getting into the decadent part of an empire just before it kind of crumbles and collapses, when everybody kind of gets lazy and stops caring about things that matter and makes celebrities out of chefs and superstars out of people that race chariots.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, here again, New Zealand is a very young country as far as modern, the Anglo-Saxon invasion, and so we're all very few generations were from people that were exploring, and by definition we're very prospective. And self-supporting. But to get back to China...
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. I was just going to say, there's a cultural thing called the number eight wire mentality, because there's this particular thickness of wire, you know, you can bend it round, and you can fix a whole lot of stuff with that. You know, you got a broken tractor or something like that. Back in the day, early colonial New Zealand, you'd be waiting 6 months for a tractor part.
Right, oh, sure.
So you got to learn how to fix it yourself, and that's kind of what's called the number eight wire mentality. Kiwis are famous for it, just coming up with some invention to make a thing. You know, world's fastest Indian, what have you. Bunch of creative people, entrepreneurs, explorers, people who push the limits, climbed Everest first, you know.
No, it's that kind of mentality that is going to survive.
What I'm saying, Victor, is that those things happened like 100 years ago, and they no longer exist.
Well, that's true, and unfortunately, in China, it's dwindling away. In fact, the second law of thermodynamics is that you always go from order to disorder automatically. Chaos is the ultimate end goal of all order, all things that are ordered. And so if you don't continually put in controls and to put in new information, that you will end up chaotic. And that's what's going. We're seeing that right now in China. The younger generation is not following the tradition of thousands of years of traditional behavior. And in fact, on television, you almost just scanning through the multiple channels of television, which are, you know, like 30 or 40 channels. There's only one or two in English, but so I don't watch television very much. In fact, almost nothing. But here, but the there's at least two or three programs being aired simultaneously that are historical events, historical behavior. Let's get back to the economy again and the government. About 400 years ago, the Chinese innovations were discovered, and one of the major innovations was silk, and then China ware. Plates and pottery and things like that, and then they had all these ceramics, and then they also had a large number of spices and then herbs like tea discovered here being grown, you know, for thousands of years, and so the people back east realized that this was a good source of new products that were specifically made here in the East and in China, and so they had the so-called Silk Route for caravans taking all these various goods from China to Europe. And in Europe, they had fiat money at that time also, and they had gold. And the Chinese, in their wisdom, would not trade with anybody in the East by using their currency. They would only accept gold as payment. And so it was lots of very expensive and highly valued products going west and gold going east and on the return trip. So that gold was hoarded, obviously, by the not only the some of the people, but also some of the government, the emperors and warlords. So
Chinese. I'm aware that the Chinese are really great hoarders. In fact, there was a number of people like bury bags of cash and things like that, and very kind of industrious at hiding their wealth and then keeping it for their grandchildren and things like that. But unfortunately, right. Sometimes the mold gets in and it destroys the currency, which I don't think would happen with gold.
No, the purchasing power of gold hasn't changed in over 2,000 years. A Roman coin that at Jesus' time was worth one coin, 1 ounce, which is one ounce of gold. That bought a very well-made, tailored cloak, a pair of sandals, and a belt, and just for that one coin. Now, today, 1 ounce is worth, it's about $15,000 an ounce.
And,
I'm sorry, got the decimal place pushed. Yeah, $1,500, and that'll buy you a nice suit, a nice belt, and a nice pair of shoes. So the purchasing power has not changed in 2,000 years.
Yeah, that makes it a good store of wealth, don't you think? Which means
that when
the price fluctuates, it has nothing to do with what the gold's doing. It has to do with what the currencies that are trying to buy the gold are doing to themselves, devaluing themselves.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, you know, the purchasing power of the gold stays constant. The only thing that causes the fluctuation is the normal methods of manipulation, which we were talking about earlier, buying paper gold.
So one who is inextricably flush with gold, as the Chinese are, don't really have to worry about any kind of economic crisis because they can back up all of their debts.
Pardon?
Because they can back their own currency.
Sure. Right. In fact, my bank account, I have two bank accounts. One is an ICBC, and the other one is the Bank of China, which is a subsidiary of the People's Bank of China. I have a gold and silver account in ICBC, which I can buy and sell gold, convert yuan into gold or yuan into silver, and then reverse from the bullion, the silver back in the yuan again at spot prices. Right now, most of my investment is in silver, and it has been deflated because of all these naked shorts, the manipulation. But I just bought some more silver just a couple of days ago because it's been deflated so much. And that's what China is doing too. Is the fools in America? Oops.
yeah. Well, the fools in America are not doing what the Chinese are doing, and that's why the Chinese economy is growing at an intense and rapid rate, similar to the years after the revolution in the United States. Incidentally, we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Just in time, head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta Superman.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I'm no Superman, but laser beams do shoot out of my eyes. If I ever see David Rockefeller walking around my country, you boy, you better watch out. A very special guest is Victor H. Fisher. Are you live from the People's Republic of China by chance?
Yes. I've been here for 4 years. Well, four plus.
Would you describe your demeanor as a Chinese nationalist, incidentally?
When you say Chinese nationalist, you just talk about Chinese citizens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they're very, very open, very helpful, very friendly. The cost of living here is, from a point of view of housing and food and travel, things like that. There's concerns about one-third the level it is in America. And so it's very pleasant. I'm in a condominium that I'm renting, and it's a four-bedroom condominium. And there's three people here. The condominium itself cost me that's 2,000 RMB a month. Divide that by 6.2, so it's pretty cheap, around $300 a month.
Whoa. This is opposed to like a week, you know, to rent like a shoebox.
all of my utilities for water, gas, electricity, and groundskeeping and things like that cost me around 700 RMB, which is a little over $100.
Got a sweet deal, man. Leaves a lot more spare money lying around for investing in gold and silver then, eh?
That's right. Even with my very, very low Social Security income.
Now, isn't that funny? How exactly did Social Security come into effect?
Well, in the States?
Yeah.
In the United States? It started out as the widow's fund for black lung disease for coal miners, and then after 1 year, it was converted over to becoming Social Security. But it was designed initially by a union leader of the coal miners. Walt Reuther, I think, was his name. And he was able to lobby Roosevelt to try to take care of the widows, because the coal miners lived in company housing and bought their food and provisions from company stores. And so they were pretty much just slave laborers. And when the income generator, the father, whoever's the income generator, dies, the remaining family is destitute and literally just thrown out into the streets.
Sad stuff.
Bad stuff, right. But that was the genesis. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's supposed to the people that we're working that they should pay into a fund, and it was claimed initially as being a sort of an insurance trust. But more recently, the politicians, in their glee to buy votes, have been robbing that trust and so now it's getting losing its trustfulness. But hopefully that's going to change when we convert into a collateral-based dollar instead of a debt-based dollar.
Can I ask you then, what do you think the New World having this basically hollowed-out destruction or collapse of the U.S. economy and hence U.S. power around the world, and probably Europe will follow it into the pit, what kind of new structure do you think would be imposed on the world by those who have the remaining money?
Well, it's as far as currency is concerned, my vision, and based on fairly substantial investigation, is that we're going to be reintroducing Bretton Woods' scheme for currency, which was a gold-based system. But at that time, in 1947, the United States had 20,000 tons of gold, and they claim to have 8,000 now. But I, as I said earlier, I think that they have zero, a negative amount of bullion. So the United States is in real bad problem. There's a high probability that there's going to be a major deflation. Depreciation of the value of the gold, of the Treasury dollar, and compared to the Federal Reserve dollar. Because there's too many contracts out there using the word dollar included in it, and many countries have used the dollar as their basis for their currency. So they the name is going to stay the same, but the value is going to be very much changed. But in the Bretton Woods setup, each country had a choice of the currency, type of currency that they were going to have, and the value of that, the purchasing power of that currency is going to be calculated and established so that exchange rates will be basically semi-frozen. And what I mean by semi-frozen, if the political politicians in any country wants to inflate the value of their gold, their currency, then they, by definition, they're going to deflate the purchasing power, and that'll be done on a continuous analysis of all of the different currencies in the nearly 200 countries in the world. But it'll be this business of having to buy dollars just to purchase foreign goods, that'll be totally removed.
Well, Victor, we've only got a minute or two left in the broadcast. I think we should probably reserve this for you plugging your books and so forth, because you do need more money to buy gold, don't you?
That's for sure. Well, my book is you caught me when I closed up, but it's Improvement of Your Thought Process. I think that's the name, and it's a Kindle book. The way you can get it is go to Kindle store, and it. Just use in the selection at the just say Victor Fisher Psychology if you want, and that's VictorFisher, and then Psychology, and there's others involved. Thought will be as another keyword. And then I'll take you to the page for the purchase of the book. So it's a Kindle book. Describes my research back in 62, 63, and it also, I have a series of publications, one from the Journal of American Medical Association back in 62, April in 62, which verified that my research on the Heifrig and the patent on the Heifrig is okay.
You can finish your sentence. Got about 20 seconds.
No, that's something okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. Something about the Heifrig cliffhanger, ladies and gentlemen. You'll have to wait until he comes on next time.
Okay.
All right. And also Google Victor H. Fisher. I Googled that the other day, and there's an awful lot of work that this guy has done. And in fact, I've had him on the show a number of times. Really, really interesting interviews if you want to understand the human mind. And this is the first time we've gotten to talk economy. And that was very enlightening too. Victor, thank you very much for your time.
All right. Try to please.
Yeah, indeed we do. We'll see you again sometime. And you too, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening.